This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. As the year comes to a close, we here at the State of Things like to take a moment to look back at the people and the stories that stuck with us. In 2019, we met musical visionaries, people fighting to save endangered cultures, and folks who supported their neighbors through another devastating hurricane. Laura Pelliser is a producer with the State of Things. She's here to take us through those standout stories and a few other significant moments on the show. Laura, one of the most significant moments on the show this year is the fact that you have moved on to do some other spectacular work for WUNC.
I have, but I am not going far, Frank. I have, as you know, I have switched seats, and
you
I
did.
Am four seats away.
If you were to leave the building, we would have put up a bigger ruckus about the whole thing, and those recommendations would not have been forthcoming.
Right.
However, since you're going to work with our fabulous online team mm-hmm. to create stories and produce content and do all the good things that you do, plus, we're going to let it happen. You're fabulous. So there we are. I just want to set that out right away. Mm-hmm. And here's the thing about Laura. Here's the thing you have to know about Laura. If I tell her everything I think about how great she is and what she's meant to the show, she's going to cry. And then we're not going to get through this. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to save all that to the end.
And I take that comment, and I appreciate it, because I am very comfortable with my emotions. And as
That's
you know,
good.
I'm a hugger.
Yes.
So I hope that we get to hug it out at the end of this conversation
We're going to do all that. And all of that emotion is what makes you great and what has helped make this show so well. So let's talk about some of the things that, and your reflections really over the last year, and I suppose your tenure on the State of Things, your sense of what all this has meant.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, looking back at the past 3 years that I've spent with the State of Things, one of the things, the big reflections about working on this show is that it is a show where we get to think a lot bigger than just kind of daily news coverage. We learned, and I learned, how to think how to look at the bigger system. We often delve into conversations about racism, about sexism, about capitalism. It really is about the bigger structure that has made this news story happen, made it the thing that it is. And so I feel like this was sort of a boot camp. It was a training to learn how to take my stories and go about six steps bigger than what you see in the headline.
You did a lot of that and helped make this show much better. Talk about your first clip and the first State of Things from this past year that you'd like to talk about.
Well, I wanted to bring a lot of characters, really important characters that have stood out for me. And someone who stands out is Laura Balance. So she is a big deal, a real big deal. She is the bassist with Superchunk. She is also co-founder of the legendary record label Merge Records. Mm-hmm. I grew up, you know, listening to bands that she signed, like Arcade Fire. What stood out for me about our meet conversation with her is that she really opened up about her experience with the paranormal and with ghosts. And so that's the clip that I selected.
On my mom's side particularly, every time we'd go to visit my grandparents in Charlotte, they would, after dinner, they'd have had some drinks, and they'd get out the Ouija board. And all of us kids would still be around as it started. And, you know, we'd watch them, and there would be these dramatic exchanges with various spirits from the other side. And there was also a house spirit that protected them, supposedly. His name was Christoph. And we would sometimes think that we saw him outside the windows. Like we could see him looking in, which, you know, I don't know if that was just an overactive imagination on the part of us kids, but definitely things happened in that house. And
What kind of things?
For me, one of my most vivid personal memories is one time I was staying with my grandparents, and this was during the daytime even. I rounded the corner to go up the stairs up to where the bedrooms were. And as I was coming around the corner, I look up and I see two figures sort of floating down the stairs towards me, holding hands. And the one weird thing about it was one was sort of reddish and one was sort of bluish. Hmm. And I turned around and ran away. But, like, I never forgot that.
Now, did you feel free to report these things? Obviously, these are people who pull out the Ouija board, so you
right.
might feel free to report these kind of things to the family, or didn't you?
I, I'm sure I told somebody.
And did they, did this, I mean, you know, you talk about a house spirit, and it's a thing that was palpable enough. In other words, they talked about it in a way.
Oh, yeah.
This is creating images, and would it govern behavior? You know, we're not going to do that because Christoph said don't? Or
no. Yeah. No, he was never like a disciplinarian. Yeah. Except one time, they had sent us to bed. Often, after they got the Ouija board out and got things going, they would get like, okay, kids, time to go to bed. And, you know, me and my cousins would just, you know, we'd wander off and make our way to the bedroom through the dark. Yeah. And I remember one time we were upstairs. We were supposed to be asleep, but we had the lights on. We were jumping between the beds, playing around, and suddenly the lamp goes click and turns off. And we were all just like, and we thought, Christoph has decided it's time for us to go to bed.
That's good. Well, what did you make of the other episode, the couple coming down the stairs in 3D vision? Well, I mean, what did you make of that?
It was a normal part of my reality. Yeah. So, it scared me. I didn't feel personally threatened by it, but I didn't want to interact with it the way that it seemed to want to interact with me. I don't know. It was just part of my reality, but one that I couldn't count on. It would just appear all of a sudden sometimes, and often would surprise me. Like, it never happened when I was looking for it. It was always
Was it that things that palpable, that like human figures, or did you experience things in other ways that were sort of.
Yes. Let's see. When I was 18, I was staying at my mom's house in Raleigh. So this is a different location even. Yeah. So it follows me around. I was going to UNC, and I would go back and stay in Raleigh at her house sometimes when I was visiting friends in Raleigh. And I had come in late. It was like 3 in the morning. And my stepfather was a little bit of a prankster. And sometimes when I'd come home late at night, I would hear Hard Soul Shoes walking around upstairs and at 3 in the morning. And I thought it was, oh, that's Dan. What a jerk. In hindsight, I wonder. But anyway, one night I was on the verge of falling asleep and suddenly snapped back awake because I could feel something pressed up against my back, like a person laying next to me in the bed. And I'm certain that no one had gotten in the bed with me. And I did what any sensible person does in that situation, and I closed my eyes and sweated and just prayed to go back to sleep.
Yeah.
Because I didn't want to turn around and see what it was.
All right, that was a clip from Merge Records co-founder and Superchunk bassist Laura Balance talking about her relationship with the paranormal. And that's one of the conversations that stood out to producer Laura Pelliser, who I'm talking with today. And you also wanted to bring someone that we spoke with under very different conditions. We reached out to an Ocracoke Fisher person and a volunteer firefighter, Teresa Ray. Tell us more about what was going on the day we reached her.
So we reached Teresa Ray on the day, it was the morning essentially after Hurricane Dorian had passed through Ocracoke. She was one of the folks on the island who was really caught off guard by extreme flash flooding. She is an experienced disaster response person, but she was caught in her home and saw that her home flooded up to 3 to 4 feet. That still did not stop her for 1 second from rescuing other people from floodwaters.
Let's hear some of that conversation.
There's several commercial fishermen going out doing home rescues. A few people have been stuck in the attic. We have gotten to them. It's totally flooded. It's crazy. I've never seen this. I've been here since 97.
And you say this is the worst flooding. This is the worst flooding you've seen there in that 20-some years.
Yes.
It's interesting because you thought the worst was over, right? And then came the flash floods. Tell us what happened.
Well, we went through the eye of the storm briefly. I'm not sure the time, maybe 7:30-ish. I was centrally located in the village, and then I left to go to my house. And by the time I got to my house, within 5 minutes, there was 4 feet of water in my yard. And then it kept on rising. It's about 3 feet inside the house. I had to go retreat to the upstairs. And luckily, another commercial fisherman, I desperately called him, and he came and rescued me first. And then I just went and helped him with about 5 or 6 people. And then I've been staying at the station helping wherever I can, do whatever I can.
Well, tell us about those rescues. Where were people? What kind of condition were they in? And where were they?
They were in, of course, everything's low-lying around here. They were across from the variety store on West End Road. We rescued 2 elderly gentlemen and their dogs. They had to wade through about 4 feet of water to get into the boat. And, it's insane. I'm looking at the side of a trailer, a camper trailer right now, with the whole end of it blowed off.
Wow.
Cars flooded. Cars are floating. Crazy, man.
And a bit of a, as I say, and you must know, a bit of a surprise, because as you said, you were about to go home. You thought the worst was over. I guess this much had to do with an unfortunate timing with the floodwaters, the rain, and then high tide, right?
Yes, I guess about 7, like I said, 7:40-ish, the wind, came from the northeast, and that's where we started getting the flood. And it came down the road. It looked like a wall of water.
That is commercial fisher and volunteer firefighter Teresa Ray talking about her experience during flash flooding on Ocracoke from Hurricane Dorian. One of our producer Laura Pelliser's picks from 2019. We'll continue that conversation just ahead on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. We're looking back at 2019 producer picks today. Laura Pelliser is on the hot seat talking about her favorite picks. And you talked earlier about the process of putting together the Monday Meet. I know you've talked about that before on this show. That is a special kind of a program. Tell us about that.
So with a Monday Meet, you have a very rare opportunity in journalism to take a lot of time to get to know someone. And this happens in the pre-interview process before we even bring them on air. So during the pre-interview, it can almost be like therapy sometimes. Sometimes we as producers help people make connections in their own lives, linking the beginning and the middle and, the later years of their life. And it's a really special experience and something that I think it's sort of a blessing in a way to be able to do that in journalism and take an hour or 2 hours on the phone with someone. So someone who stood out for me is Renee Fink. She's a Holocaust survivor. She lives in Chapel Hill. Her story was just extraordinary, and we don't have time to sum it all up here, but I wanted to pull a clip from her talking about why it's so important for her to keep talking about her story.
So I speak, and I feel compelled not to turn any requests down. I began many years ago, even before the Holocaust Speakers Bureau, with a particular teacher in One Durham Middle School, and these were young children. I just had to tell the story, had to make people aware how evil and ugly war is. And it was never about me. I don't want to focus on me. And this whole hour with you, talking with you, is a pleasure, but the focus on me feels somehow not quite correct. It was to enlighten people about the signs, and we are living in the midst of so many of these danger signs today. So it was to remember war, to bring home to younger children, also adults, and I've spoken at universities, high schools, and clubs, organizations, churches. Just the ugliness.
What are some of those signs that you see today?
Before Trump was elected, I could see clearly the handwriting was on the wall about his xenophobia, his narcissism. There was a seeming prejudice of the other, whether we come from Mexico, no matter where we come from, the nationalism, the white supremacy, that America first. this country of America is nothing but a group of immigrants, except for the Native Americans. This is what has made this country so rich. Unlike the totally homogeneous societies, we've had more creativity, more of everything that's good from this rich immigrant mixture. Mr. Trump was clearly putting an end to all that. When the thing happened in Charlottesville, Virginia, and he said there are good people on both sides, I got quite sick, because what can you say after that? That kind of says it all, when he's calling Nazis good people.
And we have forgotten, it seems to me. You have some startling statistics about what we don't know and what we don't remember about the Holocaust.
When it's alarming when you think that 10% of Americans have never heard of the Holocaust, are unfamiliar with the word. I have one friend who thought it was a kind of food group. She was a college professor, so she created a Holocaust teaching. I don't know.
Like a curriculum that you have.
She created a curriculum around teaching Holocaust at her college.
And you've helped to develop a curriculum yourself.
I didn't help develop it, but the North Carolina Council on the Holocaust, namely Marianne Wason, created this magnificent text. It says, "The Holocaust, a North Carolina Teacher's Resource." And it features the narratives of Holocaust survivors who became North Carolina residents. So it makes it very human for students to work with this book.
Do you think knowing about this does make a difference? When you think about the fear and the anxiety that has developed this infection that we have in the United States now, we've got camps at our border. We're separating children from their families in the name of the United States of America. Does knowing about this going to make any difference, or is the fear and anxiety too deep?
I am so hoping that as we hear more and more about the separation of children, I don't know how many thousands, some die. We hear about the few who have died in custody. They are being separated from their parents and not being, this is not America. This is a very dangerous country as we know it today. And we have got to get out of this mindset very quickly. It's an emergency, as is climate change. I mean, our country is in dire straits.
That was a segment of our conversation with Holocaust survivor and Chapel Hill resident Renee Fink and one of producer Laura Pelliser's picks from 2019. And Laura, this year you put together an exploratory conversation about efforts being made across the state to save indigenous language. And you were passionate about this. I mean, we all care, but you were absolutely passionate about this.
Yeah, it's something that I've kept my eye on for a long time. I'm really interested in indigenous culture, but also the fight that's being led by a lot of indigenous activists and folks within American Indian communities to save pieces of their own culture. So we met this gentleman. His name is Marty Richardson. He is the director of the Haliwasaponi Historic Legacy Project, and he rediscovered an ancestral language called Tutelo Saponi. It's his own ancestral language. And he essentially taught himself that language from scratch, from books, physical books in a library. And he is now considered to be one of only a handful of fluent or nearly fluent Tutelo Saponi speakers in the world. And he's helping to teach others as well.
Let's listen to a bit of our conversation with Marty Richardson.
We were singing the songs of other tribes, and we were singing in different languages. And so we really didn't have a way to express ourselves. And one of our tribal elders, Arnold Richardson, he had done some work with Saponi. He had found some word lists that were recorded back in the 1700s, the 1713, 1714. And so he really got me interested just to know that there was some of our language that was there. But the other process that I went through was that I was living in Baltimore, Maryland at the time. We had moved up to Baltimore for my parents to find jobs and things like that. And so a lot of times people would ask me who I am, what I am. And so when you come into processes like that and folks kind of questioning who you are, you really take a look at yourself and say, well, what do I know about myself? And that's kind of what happened when I was in middle school and then in high school. And so that kind of set me off on a journey to find out more about my people, about my Haudenosaunee people. And through that process, by knowing that some of the Saponi language had been written down, I started looking at Saponi, and I noticed that the Tutelo tribe was one of the allied tribes and also spoke the same language as the Saponis. And then from there, I found out that there was a lot more of the language that had been recorded. And so as a 14, 15-year-old, I started doing research. I go to local libraries, I go to local universities, and I found the published articles on Tutelo, and that's kind of what set me off as far as learning about the language. And then from those articles, I also learned that there were unpublished materials at the National Anthropological Archives. And so as a 15, 16-year-old, I had my parents drop me off in Washington, D.C., and
You made them drive you from Baltimore to D.C. so you could do your research.
They did.
Well, at least you were doing your homework. Well, what did they say about all this? I mean, your interest in this, is that something that they were proud of? Or?
Well, they were happy that I was doing some native stuff and not listening to so much hip-hop.
That was some of our conversation with Marty Richardson, the director of the Haudenosaunee Historic Legacy Project. He's considered to be one of only a handful of nearly fluent Tutelo Saponi speakers in the world and one of Laura Pelliser's favorites. And I understand that a significant development came out of that conversation. Talk about that.
Well, it was quite remarkable because we had Anna Louisa Degno, who's the program director for Living Tongues Institute for Endangered Languages, on that program at the same time as Marty Richardson. A lot of magic happens sometimes outside in the green room before and after the show. And after this particular conversation, Anna and Marty caught up with one another and they started plotting. And what has happened since then is that Marty Richardson and Anna have teamed up and they are currently using a mobile app that was recently developed to record a talking dictionary on a phone. It makes it so that this dictionary of the Tutelo Saponi language is accessible to anyone who's got a smartphone. So it's some really special project in the work there.
Great stuff. You know, I was thinking that green room magic that you talk about, it has happened many, many times. Lots of people have met and then created projects. And I was thinking we could have our own version of kind of the tiny desk concert where we have, you know, the sort of the tiny desk marriage, the green room marriages that happen from the state of things. That could be a segment on the show. But that's for another time. I know you wanted to highlight one of the live broadcasts we did this year, right?
Yes. So one of the things about working in radio is we are broadcasting over mysterious airwaves in a very ethereal way to folks that we cannot see. And so something special about this program is that we actually go out and we meet people, and we meet the people that we are broadcasting to. So once a month, as folks know, we are in Greensboro. And once in a while, we do a really special show and we deliver it to an even bigger in-person audience. So in this case, we teamed up with UNC's Hussman School of Journalism and Media. We took our show to them and we did an hour-long special recording about hate, harassment, and the right to report. So it was centered on the First Amendment. We ended up talking about hate speech on the internet. We also talked about diversity in newsrooms and how that is a critical issue that still needs to be tackled.
Well, in this clip, we're going to hear from the executive director of the International Women's Media Foundation, Elisa Liz Munoz, talking about diversity in journalism. And we'll also hear the voice of Alan Johnson, who's the executive editorial page editor of the Greensboro News and Record and the Winston-Salem Journal.
I hate to say it, but journalism is not a diverse industry, and it should be. It should really reflect our societies, and it doesn't. Most journalists are white, most journalists are men, particularly at the higher levels of media organizations, owners, publishers, editors. As you get into the reporter level, it evens out a little bit more, but still, the last studies that were done, it's somewhere between around 30% of journalists are women. And that being coupled with almost 90% of journalism students and journalism graduate students being women. So one of the things that I often wonder is where is that cliff? Where do they fall off?
That's what I was going to ask you. What are the barriers? Are they not entering? They're entering, but not they're expressing an interest in journalism, but not making it into the industry. They are not staying in the industry.
They're not staying. Yeah. They're not staying in the industry. And it's like all glass ceilings. You know, if you don't see yourself, you don't see yourself, and you're not going to aspire to be that, and so you leave. There's a lot of inequity that has been documented around. Beats around pay, equal pay issues, etc. I personally do not buy the line that it's a tough job. It's a tough job for families. It's a tough job for women because of they want to have children. I just don't buy it. I know too many journalists who want to be there and who can't be there.
Well, I wonder if the social media attacks and some of what we were talking about earlier, the fact that it is having such a profound effect, and now there are these platforms that can just be more powerful in their mm-hmm. reach and their impact is also creating another barrier. In other words, if they hadn't been there,
Absolutely.
Maybe we'd see a steady rise, but we're losing that now.
Yeah, I think the fact that women are targeted, particularly online, does and has driven women out of the industry. I mean, I know several personally, and we've documented it through surveys and research, so that's well documented that women and those from other underrepresented communities also drop out of the news industry because it is all-consuming. I hope that I'm making clear how it overtakes your life when you open your computer and all you see is this kind of hate and attack constantly. And unfortunately, it's juxtaposed against a culture where it is this tough macho culture where they feel if I speak up, I'm not going to be sent on that beat. If I speak up, I'm going to be seen as a wilting flower and I cannot be trusted with these assignments. And so there's this hesitancy to really address them seriously, even within the journalist herself, for fear of backlash.
And you can't ignore social media because it's part of your job these days. It is integrated into news gathering, so it's part of what you do.
Yes.
You can't just make it go away. Ellen, what do you see as the spillover effects for recruiting women, for recruiting people of color in this industry?
Well, before we go to that, I don't want to let the industry off the hook. There's never been the kind of commitment that I felt there should be. I won't blame that on hate speech. I blame that on an industry that hadn't done what it should do. Another thing I've gone through this over my career and talking about diversifying the staff and hearing very flimsy excuses for why staffs aren't more diverse. Well, we can't find one, or we can't find one who's qualified enough, or we had one time and it didn't work out. I just have never bought that. But what has made a bad situation worse? Before I say that, I've seen too many people of color who are really good and who have done wonderful work in this profession to know that that's not true. But the other thing that's happened with the economics is we've downsized, we don't hire as much, staffs are smaller, and when we started downsizing, a lot of journalists of color were casualties. And so a bad situation didn't become worse, it became terrible. So we have all of that operating, and so I just can't blame hate speech for that. I think that complicates it, but there just hasn't been all along the effort that it should have been.
Elise, I know you're running a campaign called Check Your Bylines. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, our Check Your Bylines campaign is basically a challenge to all of us to take note of who we're reading, what news we're consuming, who's in your news feed. I think at the end of the day, most of us will be pretty surprised by who is influencing our view of the world, and it's mostly older white men. And so it's a challenge to spend some time to check those bylines and to try to diversify them. And I just want to be clear, I think that everybody can be a great journalist, and white men are great journalists. I just think that we should have a diversity in the field that is representative of our communities. And just check your bylines. I encourage you to do so.
That was Elisa Liz Munoz, Executive Director of the International Women's Media Foundation, and Alan Johnson, Executive Editorial Page Editor for the Greensboro News and Record and the Winston-Salem Journal, And their conversation is one of producer Laura Pelliser's highlights from the year. And it's one of the, we're always live. Of course, our show is always live, or most often our show is live, but not always in front of a live audience. And I wonder if that's different for you as a producer and what that does to your life when you have to think about producing a show in front of a live audience.
Well, I'm not going to lie, Frank. It's a little bit more pressure. But thankfully, for this conversation, we teamed up with our brilliant intern, Josie Taris. She did a lot of the legwork of trying to find the right people. We really try and stay conscious of diversity on this show. Who are the people telling their stories? Do they have a personal story to tell? So we tried to reflect that in the conversation that we put together. And I think that it worked out. I think that we had a really diverse selection of people from different backgrounds. We had Alan Johnson, a brilliant journalist with decades of experience, and he had a lot of personal stories to share from the newsroom. And then we had a number of academics who were able to share their different research areas.
Laura Pelliser is here, producer on The State of Things. She has moved on, but she had a great year with us and is talking about the things that stood out, and she will continue to do that on The State of Things when we return. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. It's an end-of-the-year tradition here on the show. Producers dig through their favorite conversations from the past year and bring us some of the moments that resonated with them and our listeners. Laura Pelliser is here talking about some of hers. Let's go back and talk some more. What's your next pick?
I wanted to take a bit of a hard turn. We've been talking about some of the characters that we've met, some of the really poignant stories. But I wanted to take a hard turn and talk about science, because we both nerd out on science pretty hard on this show. We've talked before about how you've emerged from your office with, you know, printouts of information from NASA about black holes, or about, you know, fire ants. I think at one point we were going doing a deep dive on the show about that. But so
tardigrades, by the way.
Tardigrades.
Just still freaking me out.
I know. And really, and they're incredible creatures. But so I wanted to talk about the dung beetle, because this is one of the conversations that stood out for me. We spoke with entomologist Clyde Sorensen. He is just a beetle fanatic, has made a career out of it. And it doesn't hurt at all that he has a voice exactly like Sam Elliott, like actor Sam Elliott. So he's incredible to have on air. And we had this conversation as part of Bug Fest, which happens annually at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences. Such a fun event. And here is what Clyde had to say about the beetle.
So beetles have probably been around somewhere between 250 and 300 million years.
So they know what they're doing. They're highly successful.
Very, very ancient. And because of the way a beetle is built, they can live in virtually any kind of habitat. And that's why we find them living in the water, inside trees, under piles of cow dung. They can live almost any place with the kind of wings they have and still maintain the ability to fly.
Including underwater. There's like the Sea Hunt. They got Mike Nelson. Mike Nelson?
Yes. There's lots of beetles that are that dive after prey. So and they carry a little air bell of air with them under their wings when they dive. And
Whoa, they carry it under their wings?
Yeah.
So what do they have to get, like, do they use, they draw the air then from an outside, like a nose?
So, well, insects don't breathe through their nose, they breathe through their abdomen.
Yeah.
Little holes alongside their abdomen. And so beetles have these really cool front wings called elytra. That's what makes them have that hard shell look to them.
Mm-hmm.
And the diving beetles have, underneath their elytra, they have a lot of little hairs that trap air, and so they go underwater, they have this bubble of air trapped around their abdomen, and it functions like almost like an aqua lung. And as they deplete the oxygen in that little bubble of air, more oxygen moves in from the water. And so they can stay underwater for a really long time, chasing minnows, tadpoles, whatever.
Then the oxygen is being absorbed through their skin, just the way a land beetle would. But
right.
It's now trapped
under
there.
Through the little holes in their abdomen.
But that means they also have to be able to extract oxygen from water, or at least the bubbles, the dissolved oxygen.
Yeah,
right?
The bubble pulls dissolved oxygen from the water as it's depleted in the bubble.
This is
really
very
cool.
And this also the number of species suggests a greater amount of specialization. Right, they figured out how to find the niche.
That's what's really remarkable about beetles is if there is a niche to live in, there's probably a beetle living in it, and so they can occupy little tiny patches of habitats. They can occupy habitats that most other animals simply can't exploit because they can't fly to find them. They can't fly to exploit them. And so they're really, really powerful.
And the dung animals. Beetle figured out long ago that the world is full of enough food for them to actually make a living.
Dung beetles are just one kind of beetle. They're in the family Scarabaeidae, which means nothing to y'all.
What's scarab? I heard
likely,
scarab in there.
Scarab is probably significant. So scarab beetles are kind of historically significant, right? So the sacred scarab in ancient Egyptian religion, it's a dung beetle. It's a big, big dung beetle.
Wait, the scarab? Those are dung beetles?
It's a big dung beetle.
Oh, dear.
Yep.
But they must have known that, and yet it was because you would have paid attention.
Oh, yeah.
Anybody can build a pyramid
so,
knows what that beetle is doing.
Yeah, so they actually worshipped it because it was a dung beetle, because they saw it was one of the rollers. We could get into this in a little bit, but
yeah.
It was one of those that makes a ball of dung and then rolls it away and buries it. And they saw in that process there a metaphor for the passage of the sun. And then they also saw a metaphor for their belief in a rebirth after death, in that they would bury this ball of stuff,
mm-hmm.
and then sometime later, a brand new beetle would come out of the ground.
Uh-huh. That is Clyde Sorensen, an entomologist at North Carolina State University, part of a conversation about dung beetles, and one of the ones that producer Laura Pelliser picked for 2019 is one of her favorites. Another scientific conversation that rose to the top for you is the science of sleep.
Yes, this is a very personal topic for me, and it's something that I petitioned to produce for our new series on the state of things called Embodied, conversations about sex, relationships, and your health. It's hosted by Anita Rao. This conversation really hits close to home because I am just a total night owl. So I had the privilege of recruiting Jade Wu, who is a licensed clinical psychologist at Duke University and also a night owl, and she specializes in sleep. And she came on the show and talked to us about circadian rhythms, about how not everyone is on the same circadian rhythm clock, which was mind-boggling for me and explains a lot of things. So it was a real pleasure to have her on.
Well, let's listen to some of that conversation between Anita Rao and Jade Wu, a licensed clinical psychologist at Duke University who does specialize in behavioral sleep medicine.
So there are two main types of sleep. One is called REM sleep, that stands for rapid eye movement, and the other type is creatively called non-REM. So these are the two main categories. And so non-REM sleep is further broken up into stage 1, 2, and 3, basically light, medium, and deep. And deep sleep is also known as slow wave sleep, delta sleep, deep sleep. And during non-REM sleep, there's a lot of body repair, growth, restoration of the body, rest. So for example, human growth hormone peaks in how much is being released in the body during deep sleep.
Hmm.
So that's why kids need a lot of deep sleep because they're growing. Sex hormones are also being released during this stage. That's why teenagers also need a lot of sleep because they're going through puberty. And we're also consolidating memories. So the things that we're learning throughout the day, whether it's from a textbook or whether it's from the free throw line, we're actually continuing to learn and improve during sleep. And what else? Memory consolidation. And the brain is also doing some janitorial work, very important janitorial work. We're clearing out debris from the cerebral spinal fluid, that just basically junk in the brain that we don't need. And with this clearing out, we're sort of resetting and we're maintaining brain health. So if we're not getting enough deep sleep, then we don't have enough opportunity to do this important clearing out work. And the debris can build up over time into unhelpful protein plaques and tangles that are implicated in Alzheimer's disease.
Right. So not getting deep sleep and not going through all these various stages not only impacts our mental health and our feelings of restfulness, but actually
mm-hmm.
like the physiological processes that are happening in
Absolutely.
Our body.
Absolutely. That's why it's extremely important for young people, especially, to get the sleep that they need so they can properly develop their bodies and their brains at these very critical periods.
You've also said that looking at shift workers and kind of this struggle in
the changes in circadian rhythm can tell us a lot about how important sleep is. Tell me a bit about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So shift workers are actually at higher risk for health problems and mental health problems. And in fact, shift work is the only non-chemical carcinogen, probable carcinogen, on the carcinogen list. So that tells you how big of a problem it is. And it's not just about sleep. It's not just that shift workers are not getting as much sleep. It's that their biological clocks are thrown off. And that's a real problem. And we're finding out more and more that, you know, we shouldn't just be talking about sleep. That's like talking about yin without talking about yang. Doesn't really make sense. It's really about the 24-hour cycle and the consistency of that cycle and the health of that cycle.
So tell me about that 24-hour cycle and the circadian rhythm. And you have a great metaphor, I think, about a train station that helps us understand.
Yeah, this is what I share with patients. So I like to think about the circadian system, which is not just one brain area or one thing that's happening in your body. It's a network of lots and lots, in fact, billions of different clocks in your body, with one central clock in the brain called the suprachiasmatic nucleus. So we can call that SCN for short. And the whole system is like a busy train station with that one big clock tower in the middle, and every passenger and train conductor and ticket salesperson has their own watch to look at, right? So imagine if that big clock tower just randomly changed its time and or ran at a different speed, or you could never really predict what that was going to say, and everyone's desperately trying to tune their own watches to that main clock, how chaotic of a train station would that be, right? So ideally, all the trains are running on time, all the passengers and everybody has the same time on their watches that runs at the same speed. So the whole biological system is similar. We want all of our cycles to be running in sync with each other for optimal health.
I'm talking with Jade Wu. She's a health psychologist at Duke specializing in behavioral sleep medicine. This is Embodied Today on the State of Things. So we've heard this night owls and early birds or morning larks. So mm-hmm. Do we all have the same circadian rhythm, or is there actual naturally occurring differences?
There are definitely naturally occurring differences. So we are all biologically wired to be either a morning lark, a night owl, or somewhere in the middle. And this is largely driven by genetics, so we can't help it. And there's actually differences in the length of our cycles depending on what we have. So, for example, I'm a night owl. So I probably don't have a 24-hour cycle. I probably have something more like a 24.3-hour cycle, meaning if I had no social obligations, no work, and I lived in a cave, I would just want to go to bed early, later and later each day and wake up later and later each day, whereas people who are morning people tend to have closer to a 24-hour cycle, though the average, I believe, is about 24.1 hours.
Why are there these differences? Is there any advantage, or was there in the past?
Well, it's hard to say, but my pet theory is that back in the day, you know, some people in the tribe had to be restless at night while everybody else was sleeping to keep an eye out for nocturnal predators, right? So I like to say, you're welcome. We're like the night
you, Dave.
We're like the night watchman who walked around and kept everybody safe.
That's part of a conversation between Anita Rao and Jade Wu, who is a licensed clinical psychologist at Duke University who specializes in behavioral sleep medicine, and one of this year's episodes of Embodied, State of Things series that explores sex relationships and your health. Also one of producer Laura Pelliser's favorite conversations from 2019. And Laura, you brought a musical pick to round out your selections. Tell us about Mipso.
I think it's always fun to round out these conversations with a little jam, a little bit of music from here in North Carolina. So Mipso is a very hardworking band that's based here, but they're very hard to pin down. So it has actually been years that I have been emailing back and forth with folks from the band, trying to get them in studio. The tricky thing is they live in all different cities. They're always on the move. So it was a real pleasure to actually get three of the four members. That was what we could do. Three of the four members in studio. So we had Joseph Terrell on guitar and vocals, Wood Robinson on bass and vocals, Libby Rodenbow on fiddles and vocals, and we should mention the group's fourth member is Jacob Sharp.
We're going to listen to the music of Mipso, but I did not have the chance to formally say goodbye to you, and in part because I don't want to. And in part because I wasn't here on your actual very last day, though, as we say, luckily, you have to know LP. She has this infectious spirit that actually brings up everybody. When I try desperately to have a bad mood because the headlines are killing me, because the conversations I have to have on the show are driving me to despair, Laura's desk is right outside my window, and her spirit and her smile and her laugh just keeps you utterly buoyed and alive in ways that all of you should experience, and any of you who listen to the show in one way or another have experienced because of her incredible work and her spirit. And I can only thank the Lord that you are only two desks away, and we're going to miss you on this show, Laura Pelliser.
Well, I promised I would cry, and I am tearing up. That's so wonderful. Thank you, Frank. I appreciate that so much.
And The State of Things is produced by Anita Rao, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, and Grant Holla-Mormon. Robin Copley is our technical director. Josie Taurus is our intern. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow. Here's the music of Mipso.
I'm not a bird with a broken wing. I just felt like walking for a while. Such a shame to race through a pretty night. We've been high for a while now. It wasn't so much falling as coming down. I wondered how the clouds looked from the ground. If you see me sometime soon, looking pale and blue, that's just the moonlight. If there's silver in my eyes, I'll be fine. That's just the moonlight. In my mind's eye view, it's you. You look up and offer me a smile. Something wild and weightless for a little while. I'll be down here moving slow and easy, just a long night on my own. I got a crescent that says I'm not alone. If you see me sometime soon, looking pale and blue, that's just the moonlight. If there's silver in my eyes, I'll be fine. That's just the moonlight. Thief didn't take anything I'd need, and just a sleepless week, an old thing that said it was easy to dance and spin. Before we got this far, picture me looking at you. If you see me sometime soon, looking pale and blue, that's just the moonlight. If you see me sometime soon, looking pale and blue, that's just the moonlight. If there's silver in my eyes, I'll be fine. That's just the moonlight.